Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, we're talking to Sean Kelly, and he's in England. He's doing virtualization at a really small radio station. I'm eager to find out what Sean has to tell us. Chris Tobin's here. Hey, Chris.
Hey there.
We are live from the NAB show Under Construction in Las Vegas in the North Hall of the Las Vegas Convention Center. Next on TWRT.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By the Ruby console from Lavo, see Lavo and your future at lavo.com/twert. By Angry Audio, audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. And by the Calrec Type R console system. Type R is a brand new, modular, expandable IP-based radio system from Calrec Audio.
Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host, live here at the NAB show for 2019. We're in the North Hall at the Las Vegas Convention Center. I happen to be in the Telos Alliance booth. And as usual, usually I'm at home in the Telos Alliance studio, but today I'm in Las Vegas at the Telos Alliance studio. I wish I could show you everything around here, but some of it's secret, and the show starts, opens Monday morning, and so if you're here, you can see all the new stuff on Monday morning. Well, welcome into the show, This Week in Radio Tech. We talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower, and we've got a great topic today because I'm going to take notes during the show because at home, I've got some hardware, some rather used hardware, that's waiting for me to apply the knowledge that I learned today. So I hope you'll stay tuned. We're talking with Sean Kelly. We'll get to Sean in just a minute. Let's bring in my co-host is here. Step on in. Hi, Chris. How you doing, man?
I'm doing well.
Good to see you.
I'm here to shape the future with you.
Shape the future. We're going to mold it. We're going to,
a little kneading.
Yeah.
Rising yeast. It's good.
I'm thinking of the kick wheel. What do you
pottery?
Call it? Pottery?
Pottery yeah.
Wheel. Yeah. Okay, we'll let that thought lapse. Hey, today you've been at a pre-convention meeting.
Yes, today started the Public Radio Engineering Conference, PREC, from the Association of Public Radio Engineers, APRE, and it was a great show, actually, a great start. Today we had IT security with our friend Jeff Welton from Nautel.
Oh, yeah.
That was fun. Also, Bill Dahlstrom from NPR. Letter M is a Mary. Time management, which was actually really good. It actually explained a few things that I could say. It was something to learn from. And then we had our folks from NPR talk about professional development for engineers. And then there's Brian Jones, who walks around with his finger in his nose. We don't know why he does that, but we have something to do with the show.
Hey, Brian, come over here and do that on camera.
And then just before lunch, we had the fill-in translator and single frequency network discussion with Joe Tymecki from VPR, the Vermont Public Radio folks, who was with Francois Gauthier from Octave Communications, and they were talking about RF. It was interesting. The VPR folks, they have a station, nice, furry flamethrower station, that has coverage issues in downtown Burlington, Vermont.
Okay.
And Joe brought in Francois from Octave. He's from Canada. And I know Francois from the CCBE. So it was really fun to sit in the room and go, wait a minute, I know who you are. I never see you here.
Yeah.
This is great. And then he has a program called Nomad. And they actually drove the signal. And you can see where the dropouts are. And like, wait a minute. And it was pretty cool.
Could they relate the dropouts to maybe specific geographic features?
Oh, yeah, everything.
Like, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Joe was able to confirm the complaints by phone with what Francois and he found with the drive and then imported through the software.
And today's not the day to tell the whole story, but literally 25 years ago in Memphis, a station I worked for had terrible coverage along the entire Outer Loop South Side, or almost the whole thing. And we were Class A, but we were right there in town, and the owner kept saying, there's something wrong with our antenna. There's something wrong with our power. There's something wrong. And I went and I drove it, marked it. Then I got a topo map, and I marked, there's a big hotel right there. And I accurately drew the hotel. The hotel shadowed a huge portion of the loop around Memphis, and that was it.
Yeah.
And I said, we can either go way up in height, or we can move the hotel.
Right.
It's up to you.
And Francois told us a story of one of his clients' station who spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on a new facility, transmitter, antenna, the whole bit. And they were concerned. The signal coverage was just not what they thought. Something's missing.
Right.
It was a directional station, so you could imagine the pattern very tight, very directional.
Okay.
So Francois, with his product, his company, the station engineer, drove the signal, mapped it out, and they discovered that the pattern – that should be, let's say, over the city of License, if you could picture a cardioid signal, was actually 180 degrees in the other direction.
What?
Now, mind you, they, there's no reason for them to know this, because when they did the return loss measurements on the antenna, they did all the specs, everything looked fine because technically it was. Mm-hmm. What they discovered was the power divider at the antenna was flipped upside down.
Oh, my God.
Now,
goodness.
Remember, it's not a bad thing, because flipping upside down doesn't change the VizWall. It's not going to make it worse. It's just going to function with a pattern. If you're an AM directional person, you know what I'm talking about, the phase shift. You know how to phase shift between towers. So basically, the power divider phase shift the other direction. Mm-hmm. You will not find that on any VizWall return loss vector network analyzer measurement.
Right.
So Francois was explaining, this is why you need to drive the signal, but you need to drive it with understanding what you have already and then compare the notes. So that's what VPR.
What a great story.
Vermont Public Radio, that's what Joe Tamicki did with him. And I'm just knowing Francois, and he's all RF. This guy, if you need to check your pattern out, this is the guy to talk to, because it's well worth it. The conversation that we had today, fascinating, because I know of two instances where after the pattern was driven, they discovered there was a problem with the antenna, mm-hmm. even though all the other specifications were right in spec.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So that was the point of the session.
And if they were getting a lot of return loss from the antenna, they would have looked for that problem a long time ago.
Yes.
So this is a problem that is hidden. It's not easily discernible unless you go do what Francois did.
Right. And technically, it wasn't an engineering error as far as like the design. It was literally the phase controller, we'll call it that, was in the wrong position.
Yeah.
So instead of being to the left, if you will, it was on the right. And on the right is no signal, no audience. On the left was the city of license. So there was money well spent, though.
Yeah.
So it was a great session. And if you want to know more about it, you can be a member of APRE, and then you can see the session. Members only can see it on the website.
Yeah.
And you know what? If you're a commercial operator, engineer, there's no reason not to be a member of APRE. Because you can learn a lot of stuff, because we all use the same thing.
So you don't have to be a public radio engineer.
No. Anybody can join.
Pay dues and join. Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And the thing is, you get access to the same stuff you get elsewhere, but in a more focused audience, focused venue.
Well, it is a very focused event.
Yes.
Yeah. It's worth the time.
Good thing to know is that RF in the public radio world and RF in the commercial world actually is the same. It applies the same laws of physics.
It works the same way.
Despite what you think.
Hey, we've got a guest that I'm really excited about. And our guest, I met this guy, or I saw a post from him. I forget if it was on Facebook or LinkedIn, but I saw a public post about some of the technology that he was putting to use. And I thought, that's exactly what I want to do. That's exactly what where I know that our industry is going in some forms or fashions. There's lots of ways to do virtualization. And so I want to introduce to you, our audience, I want to introduce my new friend, Sean Kelly from England. Sean, welcome in.
Yeah, hi, how you doing, Kurt?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad at all.
So give us the elevator speech about who Sean Kelly is. We're going to take a quick break after that, and we're going to dive right into your story and technology. Who's Sean Kelly, and what do you do?
Well, I'm a sort of an amateur stroke, semi-professional broadcaster, come DJ, come basically do anything, programmer, tech guy, network guy, you name it, we basically do it. And it's just sort of a big hobby of mine, messing around with radio. And over in the UK, as you well know, there's not a lot of opportunities over here. So we sort of just got to go out and play ourselves and see what we can get away with, really.
So I should ask you, we're going to be talking about virtualization and how you solved a problem by virtualizing. Tell you what, before we get into, after the break, some of the details, what problem were you trying to solve, or did you solve, by implementing some great IT technologies, virtualization?
Well, the biggest problem we were experiencing was a lot of the guys that wanted to get involved in radio don't have a lot of money to spend on kit and so on. And what we were looking to do was come up with a solution. So we had a good quality playout system, good quality, basically everything, good quality telephone system, and somewhere delivering that to a remote studio with very, very simple basic tools, a monitor, screen, computer, mic, and headphones, and basically just virtualizing the whole thing. So all the technology and the resources and everything—they're all held in the studio, and literally the guy could be anywhere in the world doing his show with a mouse, keyboard, and cut little bits of cheap stuff, really, basically. Mm-hmm. And that was what we were looking to try and solve.
You know, this almost sounds like in IT for years they've been doing this thin client idea. Of course, we started out many years ago with a mainframe and terminals. I got started in the 1970s with that myself as a high school kid. But so it almost sounds like thin client radio, where you have a minimal amount of gear, where the presenter is the live presenter, and then, you know, all your good stuff, the back end, is all either in the cloud or in your data center or at your main studio.
Well, that was exactly what we were looking at doing. We have a particular supplier that came up with a solution with an eye-watering figure with it. So I thought, I've got to be able to do this a little bit cheaper with a bit of kit from eBay. Can we solve this problem and come up with a cheap solution for the community radio sector in the UK, or even just the internet radio sector? Just, you know, come up with something that would not break the bank, basically.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, I'm interested in hearing. I understand you got started with a server, a used server for about $400, and I've just received one at my house. Mm-hmm. While I arrived here in Vegas, I saw my dear sweet mother-in-law receive this heavy box at the front door with a camera, and so that's my server that's arrived, a $200 used Dell R710. So we're gonna put that to use. I'm taking notes during the show today.
Yeah, first, strangely enough, mine's an R7 as well. So they are very heavy, very heavy. I paid about $400 for mine. It arrived in a massive box, shockingly heavy thing, and a lot of headaches to get it working. But it's sat there, and it's now performing pretty much what we tried to achieve.
Well, good deal. When we come back from the break, we're going to hear first of all about, you know, some of the functionalities that it does, and then I want to understand how you came to how you built it. You know, what were the base? You know, not step by step keyboard instructions, but, you know, what did you install? How did you install? And what'd you run up against? Hey, folks, you're tuned into This Week in Radio Tech, the weekly show where we talk about radio technology, and today we're talking about virtualization with somebody who's actually done it on the smaller scale that frankly I want to, and other small broadcasters want to. Or at least I think they want to. Those who know what they're doing want to. Our show is brought to you in part by our friends at Calrec, and we'll be right back right after this.
Calrec Type R is a modular, expandable IP-based radio system featuring three slimline panels, a fader panel, a large soft panel, and a small soft panel, easily configured to give the operator full control. Layouts are saved and recalled quickly between shows. A single 2RU core with integrated I/O gets customers up and running fast, and that single core can power up to three independent mixing environments with no sharing of DSP resources. Available in four DSP packs, and as your station grows, larger packs can be added, enabling it to grow with you. Power to the surface is supplied via standard PoE switches, keeping cabling to a minimum. Type R is fully AES-67 compatible, as defined by SMPTE 2110, which means that it is also compliant with NMOS discovery and connection management specs. All these features combined make Type R the most flexible radio console you can buy. Find out more at calrec.com/twert.
And do go to that website, calrec.com, and add the /twert. It'll let them know that you came here because you heard about them right here on This Week in Radio Tech. Hey, you know, studio guests are only human, and humans will cough, sniff, and clear their throats, even on the air. You can cure... Hey, now! You can cure this with the Angry Audio Guest Gizmo. Press the cough button, mute the mic. Every guest needs one of these. You know what else guests need? Headphones, which is why each Guest Gizmo has a studio-quality headphone amp with individual volume control. Anything else in there? Well, you know, you've seen these gorgeous mic arms with the built-in LED tallies. They're beautiful, but how do you light them up? The Guest Gizmo does that too, illuminating the red light whenever the mic is hot. And installing the Guest Gizmo in your studio furniture could not be easier. You just need a 2¾-inch hole saw and a steady hand. No router required. Your studio gets a clean, custom appearance, and you get all the credit. Check out the Guest Gizmo and all the other cool gadgets at angryaudio.com. Angryaudio.com. And they do have some really cool gadgets there. All right. Hey, it's Kirk Harnack and Chris Tobin. We are live in Las Vegas in the North Hall. And thanks a lot to the Telos Alliance for letting us use, first of all, some of the very expensive bandwidth here. Oh, my goodness. And we're in their booth. We're in the North Hall booth. The Telos Alliance, as they have for the last several years, has two booths, one the North Hall, one the South Hall. Chris, have you ever been to the South Hall booth?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, you know, Telos Alliance offers you the solutions for both radio and television.
Yeah.
A better way to do it than in the radio section and the television section.
Yep.
It's very simple.
Yeah.
But you do have to talk to that guy. What's his name again? Ken?
Which one?
Yeah, Ken. You got to deal with Ken.
Ken Tagle?
I'm only kidding. I'm only kidding. But no, it's a wise choice. Yeah.
Oh, Ken's a good guy. I'm so lucky to work at the Telos Alliance with some amazing people. There's Juan Puñet over there. If you need to speak Spanish, Juan's got you covered right there.
Well, you know, the fun part is people don't get it, and there's only a few companies that can do this, and Telos Alliance is one of them. You have underneath the hood all of this, you know, intelligence and smarts of both how to have fun doing broadcasting, how to implement a solution for broadcasting, mm-hmm. and at the end of the day, reap the benefits of the dollars. And to do that under one umbrella, if you will, is not easy. And there are many companies who have tried that, we all know, and have failed at doing it. But Frank Foti in the beginning, Steve Church and Frank Foti had an idea, and they said, hey, I think this makes sense. And then they gathered people in the industry that know what's going on. I mean, where's Brian Jones, who I know from working in another company?
Yeah, yeah.
Same thing. He's like, oh, I know this. That he has a customer calls up and says, I got this issue with blah, blah, blah. What do I do? You go, been there, done it. Here's what you need to fix. Well, how'd you know that? Don't worry about how I know. You just called the right place.
You know,
that's what the Alliance is about, not just, you know, a piece of hardware.
Yeah.
The hardware
yeah.
is part of it. You can read about that. The part behind it, how to implement it. How does it work in your workflow and solve a problem?
Exactly. Exactly. It's a real family here.
Yes.
It really is.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And it's funny. We there's offices around the world, different people in different places doing development. Lillitz, Germany, Freising, mm-hmm. Germany, Riga, Latvia. We've got people in Beijing, mm-hmm. People in Shenzhen, China.
Mm-hmm.
Have a full-time employee there. And even in Ukraine, we've got some design people in Ukraine. It's all over the place. Yeah. Hey, okay.
So and that brings us to our guest.
Yes.
Because virtualization is what's on the roadmap here at the Alliance.
Exactly. Exactly. So we're talking to Sean Kelly, and he is in the UK. Okay. Sean, what city, town, or burg, hamlet are you in?
Well, I'm in a place called the capital of a county called Devon. The city's actually called Exeter. It's just sort of the top of in the middle of the county. It's a lovely place, mm-hmm. very, very hilly, so not very good for straight line of sight FM.
I hear you. So you gave us some of the rationale behind what you wanted to do. You wanted to have presenters either working out of their homes or other offices or not having to come into a common studio location where they could do live shows. And by the way, I'm so glad to hear that presenters there and radio where you are live is preferred and they people strive to do a live show as opposed to simply doing voice tracking. And I think that makes a difference. What do you think?
Yeah, it's one of the big things we've always pushed when I started the project a few years ago, that the stations or all the people coming in, really we want to be doing live. It gets because the stations are very localized for the area, so it was a case of aiming. It's got to be live because it's on the moment. Something happens, you're there, and you can talk to people. You can let them know, and that was the whole idea of it. I've done voice tracking myself. It's a great concept. But it still doesn't give it that ping, you know, if you know what I mean. That little bit of extra bang there, bang for the buck. It's there. The guy you're listening to is actually a real person.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, Chris, I think one of the things about being live is you end up making little mistakes and the occasional huge gaffe. And when you voice track, if you do it wrong, you do it over again.
But remember, if you're doing it live, you're doing it in real time in your location. So in the case of Sean's announcers or presenters, it's live, it's that moment, so they know what's going on in the world at that moment. They know what's happening. They can relate to something in the neighborhood or in their county or hamlet. And to give you an example, when I worked at a radio station that was taking in a satellite-delivered format from another part of the country here in the United States, I remember distinctly at least three times a week, one of the presenters would close out their show with saying, have a great day, I'm off to Knott's Berry Farm to have some fun. And I'm sitting here in Norwalk, Connecticut, listening to an announcer who's actually in California talking about going to Knott's Berry Farm in California.
Oh.
And I'm saying to myself, wow, my audience has no idea what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And it was annoying because many satellite delivered programs were doing this, and nobody paid attention. And they couldn't understand why our sales department couldn't raise revenue and go out into the community when this happens. And I was like, well, you know, if I'm listening to the station and hearing my great music, and then all of a sudden I hear an announcer say Knott's Berry Farm, I'm like, what the devil is this? I'm tuning out.
Yeah.
So if you're an advertiser, you hear the same thing. You're like, why would I bother? And I think voiceover work, or, sorry, voice tracking is good or bad. It's just, it has its place. But I think what Sean's pointing out is absolutely right. The ping, the fact that you can relate and do it. Why not do it live? And if it's from someone's home, so what? What is the big deal? What does it matter where you
are?
Sure, sure. The idea is at the end is the product being delivered the way you present it. You know, I'm presenting a radio station program. This is what we do. And at the end, the audience absorbs it, engages, and we can make money on it based on whatever you're doing. If you do voice tracking, it's not the same. Because I have a friend of mine who does voice tracking part-time, and he tells me the horror stories that he's trying to – they have him read scripts that try to make it sound like he's live, but he's not. Like, isn't he? Goes, there's no way to make this sound live.
Yeah.
Because I don't know why they write these things.
Yeah.
So just saying.
Sean, when you decided, hey, we want to let presenters – work with as little equipment as possible. So what pieces did you decide, even before you decided on virtualization, what pieces had to be in place for this to happen?
At the end of the day, the pieces need to be in place for the virtualization side of it was obviously a playout system, some sort of way of connecting that to the studio down the road or somebody's home studio. They were the key things that we had to sort of get around. And when we started looking at it, it was thin client, as you mentioned earlier, seemed to be the solution to a lot of the problems. It got around a lot of issues with sort of connectivity of bringing the local USB ports to the studios and things like that. It was quite a headache, to be honest, when we first started out, because we had originally a couple of analog studios that were linked with some very bizarre codecs that seemed to work, and everybody was going to one point. And then it was like, how do we take all that, stick it all in one place, and then make it basically anything we can get our hands on that effectively could run some operating system of some sort and allow the presenter to basically sit at home and control everything at the far end as if they were sat there. That was the big fundamental problem we hit and eventually solved, hopefully to a pretty good level, really, considering what we had to do.
So Sean, we're going to me, the juicy part of our conversation is coming up, and that's where you tell me how what you put in place with this virtualization server. Is I want to run everything on one machine, one physical machine that I can completely duplicate and back up on a backup machine. But Chris had a question about thinking about this from the other end. That is,
well, if I was I'm a presenter for your organization at the radio station, what do I have at home or at my remote my outside broadcast facility? What do I have? Because I know the audience, folks are probably listening, going, oh, yeah, virtualization servers. I get that. All great. But no one's talking about the other end, the part that's actually coming in and going out to the audience.
Yeah, okay. I mean, in the old days, you'd have your little studio. You'd have a little $50, $60 mixer, a computer, or even tape, CDs, whatever was being used, your microphone and so on, and some way of obviously connecting that to the remote studio codecs. Everybody has a computer at home of some form, whether it's a laptop, whether it's an iPad, a computer. Everybody's got one lying around somewhere nowadays. And most people have a pair of headphones and you can pick up a microphone for $20-$30. That is pretty much all we need for our solution is a computer, set of headphones and a microphone. And fingers crossed, with a little bit of free software from a certain manufacturer we'll mention in a minute, you can actually do this solution. It's quite funky when it works. But we will get to the juicy bits with that in a minute. And that's all you really need. It's a very, very simple solution. Everybody's got a bit of kit lying around to do this. And pretty much you can make it work on anything, no matter what operating system it is. You can pretty much do it.
So, I mean, I guess essentially we're talking about, obviously, remote controlling the automation. And we've been doing that since the mid-90s, at least.
Yeah.
I did that at Scott Studios. Then we have a live audio connection from the remote presenter in. And there's different ways to do that. I'd like to hear about your solution. And of course, we want to be able to, we want to send audio back so that the presenter can monitor and get close to their time cues.
Yeah, conference audio.
Presenter has a remote microphone, probably USB connected, and some headphones and their PC in front of them to, you know.
Yeah. That makes total sense. Then you could be anywhere.
Yeah. All right. Sean, we got that down pretty well, right?
Yeah, certainly have.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the juicy bit, which you've been waiting for, is that big, heavy box. Okay. These things are astronomically expensive to buy new, as you well know, Kirk. So you hit eBay, you buy one of these things, they turn up, you open it up, and it's a big slab. It's a huge thing. The first thing you do is you look at it. Half the bits are missing. I'll warn you now, when you open your box up, half the bits will be missing from it. I learned the hard way. You'll be learning that.
When you buy off lease used or refurbished servers online, you can buy them outfitted anywhere from completely bare bones without any RAM and maybe even without the processors and certainly without hard drives or maybe with just one power supply, or you can get them fully outfitted or anywhere in between. And so I've always gone for ordering, make sure it has two power supplies, make sure it has basic rated hard drives. I may add more hard drives later, but basic rated hard. And personally, I like the ones that have the 3.5-inch hard drive bays as opposed to the 2.5-inch hard drive bays. Because 3.5-inch hard drives tend to be cheaper, although you do want to get the hard drives that are rated for server service, whatever that's called. And then enough RAM. I guess you got to have enough RAM to run a number of virtual machines in there. Mm-hmm. And then enough processor cores to handle some number of virtual machines. So that's been my bit of it. I just bought one for literally $200 that I think is actually outfitted okay for me to get started. It's like 48 gig of RAM and two hard drives already rated and two power supplies. So and I think 12 cores altogether with between two
processors. That's certainly a good start. That's certainly a very good start on that. That'll get you up and running with a pretty good little system, without a doubt.
So let's get into talking about this. By the way, you could have done this without virtualizing, right? You could have just used some beige box computers on a little network and built this up that way. Could you not have?
Yeah, we could have easily done it. Like you say, a couple of machines sat in the back of the office, a bit of software, something like TeamViewer or something like that. Could pretty much have done the same sort of thing, but I think it was the challenge of virtualizing it into, as you said, a system that can be backed up, fail over, and pretty much bomb proof, like most of the actual codec type equipment is, like the cores and everything that we use here as well. Get it nice and resilient, because there's always a time when the cleaner comes through and unplugs the relevant cable that takes out your entire station.
That's right. I've given some presentations on this topic of the proliferation of beige boxes, PCs. And at my own radio stations in Mississippi, we've had this problem. So every time we wanted to add a new station or solve another problem, we'd add another PC. We'd buy some other used, refurbished Dell desktop machine, an enterprise-type machine. And before we knew it, we have a rack room with probably 18 PCs. And I realize for some people watching the show, that's not very many. For others, that's a lot. We had 18, and that means we had 18 power supplies and 18 hard drives and probably 36 fans going on. We had all this opportunity for things to fail. And when any one of them failed, there was not an immediate backup available, right? You know, we could build a new computer. We could image a new machine in a few hours. Mind you, we don't have any great technical expertise on site in Greenville, Mississippi. People willing to help, but they require exact instructions with FaceTime. So it was hours to get back on the air if we had a failure. And so we got the idea, hey, if we virtualize, we can literally back up the whole thing and have another virtualization server. And the server itself, as we kind of alluded to, has two power supplies, rated hard drives, and some things can fail. Oh, and lots of fans. So if things fail, first of all, it'll tell you on the front panel, and it'll keep on running. So you've got time. Oh, man, I got to replace that hard drive. You've got time to do that. And there's built-in controllers that automatically rebuild the hard drives. So that's to me, that's at the small station level, that's a big difference. Sean, were those advantages in your mind when you said, let's virtualize?
Yeah, that was one of the ideas when we went to virtualization. It was, as you say, you got to look at the on-air time, no dead air. Dead air is a bad thing. Only way of making sure that is not going to happen is having a failover system. And the virtualization solution probably is the best one for it because they've got these load balancing. They've got failover built into it. So within your server rack, you've got your main production environment. You've got a backup environment that's basically copying everything all the time. So if one system fails over, you know, you can switch straight to the other one in minutes, if not in seconds. And sometimes you wouldn't even notice it's happened.
Yeah, that sounds good to me. Not even notice it's happened. All right. Well, tell you what, we're going to get into the meat and potatoes of how you built your virtualization server. I'm going to consider this a lesson for me for doing as soon as I get home from NAB. I'll be downloading the things that you suggest to download. I'll probably need to make a Linux partition there, or a Linux OS on the virtual machine, because I'll put Rivendell on there probably. And I may put another automation on there as well. I could run more than one automation,
sure,
couldn't I?
Sure,
yeah. I could use Station Playout or anything else. Yeah, okay. Hey, we're going to get to that in just a minute. We're talking... Yeah, exactly. We're talking to Sean Kelly in England. And by the way, he's with Seagull FM, seagull.fm. So, hey, if you want, after the show, not during the break, but after the show, if you want to check out seagull.fm, you can see their website and listen to their live stream. So Chris Tobin and I are live at the Las Vegas Convention Center, North Hall. Our guest, Sean, is in England, and we'll be right back after this message from our friends at Broadcast Tools. I guess I'm going to be talking about that message from Broadcast Tools. So let me go to my script here. You know, the ProMix 4, that's the Broadcast Tools mixer. It is a simple mixer. It'd be perfect for doing what we're doing right here.
Oh, yes.
I have a different one here I've had for a while, but the ProMix 4 is a full-featured audio mixing console, and it's perfect for most any broadcast studio while also excelling in remote broadcast and podcasting applications. It features three microphone or line inputs that can do either duty, as well as a dedicated line input that can be switched between a balanced line input or the internal USB codec. Hey, that's really convenient. Right now, for example, we're using USB to get from the little mixer I have into the laptop, and it works, as they say in England, a treat. It works a treat. The operating system just sees that as a sound card, and bam, Bob's your uncle. Oh, I'm sorry, that's a Canadian thing. So it's got that. It also gives you a program limiter, a balanced and unbalanced mix bus, and a mix minus output. So if you need to hook it to a codec or a telephone hybrid, you got the output to do it right there, and it all works great. It offers three independent headphone amplifiers with IFB program pan controls, along with a comprehensive studio monitoring system. More features like a monaural balanced line level input, a balanced monaural output with defeatable soft clipper, built-in USB codec, LED audio output level VU meter, full duplex talkback capability. It has 3/4-inch, so professional, stereo headphone outputs with independent volume, IFB pan, and program controls. An on-air Tally warning light relay output. Hey, that's convenient. So if you want to put this into a high school or college press box, you can attach a on-air light to the door and, you know, keep people out when you're on the air. Combined with the ProMix 4 or ProMix 1 units, with the ProMix Hub 6 and standard Cat 5 cables, combine those together, you've got a real system there, and it can drive multiple AHR 1 Plus headphone systems. This is all from Broadcast Tools. Now, Chris, I know you've got experience with Broadcast Tools gear. Mm-hmm. Don Wingett and his company.
Oh, yes.
Right? The thing I've noticed about Broadcast Tools gear is when I pull it out of the box, sometimes I've got a little trouble figuring out exactly how to make it work, but by golly, once it works, it just never stops.
Well, you know, Don's approach is to always have a solution for a problem, that is.
Yeah.
And the way he goes about it is so simple. Sometimes you expect something complicated.
Yeah.
You pull one of his switches out of the box, like, okay, wait a minute. How's this connected? Oh, wait a minute. That's right. It's more straightforward than I thought. You hold this button, press this. Why do you have to hold the button? So you don't accidentally switch input one with input seven.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like as simple as that. You don't realize, oh, that's a safety button. Yeah. Hold it, switch. You know, things like that. And then all the other products. And I think that's what people miss. And this product, is just like covers all bases. And the fact that you have a tally light control is key. I know the remote broadcast that I do with a friend of mine for his sports show and his internet show, I can't tell you the number of times people have not realized we're on, we're doing our stuff. Mm. And even the guests, they decide to take the headset, throw them down the table because they think they're done. And then you hear this loud crash.
Right? Oh,
and
yeah.
It's like, oh,
yeah.
No. But if there was a tally in front of them that they're familiar with.
You know, that just happened here during this show. Right now, during the show, we had some people come and want to start talking to us while Sean was on. But we were kind of live, too.
Right.
And we had to say, oh, no, we're doing a show right. What if we had a light right here that would come on when the mics were on?
And but see, that's what I'm talking about, the solution. You know, like we have people walking up randomly just decide to talk to you on the air. Is this a radio station? What are you doing? Then you have to take a little broom and shoo them away.
Yeah.
But the solution is so simple. It's nerve-wracking because you don't realize it. And a lot of stations, and it's for under $700, you get this unit, and you got all these features. Think about it. For under $700, how do you find anything else? Plenty of people will tell you, and I've seen it done because I've had phone calls. Well, I've got this box, and this is how we do it. You do know that if you spent that same amount of money, less than that.
Get one box.
You get one box, and when you send it out with somebody, they don't have to have an engineering degree to put it together because you've got six boxes with little wires that you've got label tapes. Connect A with A, B with B, C with C. Oh, you mixed them up. Oh, you just blew the port. That's not going to work. No. And that's what Don does. That's what people don't get. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's a broadcast tools thing. No. You're losing out. You're losing on two levels. One, you're not taking advantage of your workflow success. Two, your presenters, your announcers are getting frustrated with technology so they won't do those outside events. Three, you're losing money.
So if you
can't get the job done and your presenters, who are the people who help you make the money, can't be happy, you make no money. So in other words, you're losing money because you're not buying broadcast tools products. Real simple. That's how you look at it.
You know what you should do?
Not only virtualization and the broadcast tools box, you've got it made.
Got it covered. You can go to the broadcast tools website and you can spend an hour or two there just looking over all the amazing things that Don Wingate has developed to actually solve problems. And we use a bunch of them at our radio stations in Mississippi, in Hawaii, and in American Samoa, and you probably should too. All right, check it out, Broadcast Tools. And you can get Broadcast Tools from Broadcasters General Store at bgs.cc. bgs.cc is the website, and if you give them a call, that's the best way to deal with it. You get a friendly voice when you call 352-622-7700, 352-622-7700. If you call and ask for Jessica Shute, you know she's changed her name. She got married.
Just ask for Jessica.
Just ask for Jessica. Yeah, that's right.
Or you could be really crazy and ask for Buck, and no, you're not going to get him because he's on the road all the time.
He's on the road all the time, yeah. Thanks a lot, Broadcast Tools and Broadcast General Store, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, we're at episode 438. We're live from the NAB show. Well, from the NAB setup here, we're in the Telos booth.
The pre-show.
The pre-show, as they're setting up. And we got a wild week ahead of us with more PREC, right, tomorrow?
Yes, tomorrow.
And then the SBE has functions.
SBE is partnered with the PBS TechCon folks.
Right.
So Saturday is an ATSC 3.0 event.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people say, well, why would radio people be interested? ATSC 3.0 is an IP-based system now for television.
Mm.
Let's think about this. If you're in public broadcasting and you're a radio public broadcaster, you may be partnering with your local PBS station for other things, but because of the current ATSC 1.0 limitations, you don't do a lot of things you think you could. I was just having a conversation with someone this morning about this because they look at me like, well, you're a radio station. What's the point of me being a TV station doing anything with you? I said, did you know that we produce 20 hours of video a week with musicians and artists who come in and do interviews with us on the radio? Believe it or not, on one of your secondary channels or tertiary channels, whatever you want to call them, we could be putting this stuff up there and doing a synergy or a marketing, co-marketing, co-oping, whatever you want to call it, between the two. Now you've extended your reach. And he's like, well, I said, you've just extended your television audience to a radio audience that may not even know you exist. You see where I'm going with this?
And
he looks at me, deer in a headlights approach. I'm like, okay, I'll tell you what, let's meet with your president of the company. We'll talk better. But that's what you have to look at. That's why I'm attending it tomorrow, because I'm going to see where it's going. Because the folks at One World Trade Center in New York City, they built the facility with ATSC 3.0 in mind. So think about it. Multi-million-dollar operation being put together. And this was done several years ago before ATSC 3 became what it is today. They were looking that far ahead going, hey, that's the Durst organization.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know what? Let's build this in. So this way, when it comes time, these folks can do their thing. So that's the importance of these trade shows, understanding all the different things. So public radio folks or commercial radio, you can go to the same show. It's not going to be a problem.
The NAB show itself, the expo here, starts Monday morning.
Yeah, yes.
And goes
yes.
till Thursday early afternoon.
Yep.
All right. And if you're here, by the way, you know what happens the last 9 minutes at the Telos booth.
Oh, you don't? You have to come here to find out. Sorry. Spoiler. Can't tell you.
I can't tell you.
There's a spoiler there, but I can't tell you.
All right. Let's get our spoiler from Sean Kelly. He's going to tell us how to make this, how he got this virtualization going. And Sean, I guess I'm starting out where you started out, having a little bit of IT knowledge. Certainly have built some computers and certainly installed OSs and things like that. But virtualization, I mean, I understand the concepts, but I'd like to know, you know, how to get started and what to do. Walk us through your experience.
Okay, that's it's pretty simple actually. Like you say, you only need basic skills in the computing sort of install and everything. As long as you understand that, this is pretty easy. First of all, you get your big box, you configure it, make sure you've got all your relevant stuff in there, and your drives are there. You then go to one thing I did learn, and I would say this is one thing you really got to check out, is find the custom-made image for your particular server. There are a lot of proprietary bits in those things, and they need particular drivers, especially on the Dell systems. And I should think it's the same with the HPs and every other virtual server type piece of equipment out there. So find the custom version that was written for your particular machine. There are newer versions. We've tried experimenting with the newer versions. We've rolled back to the one that's recommended for that particular machine for its lifespan. It takes 10 minutes to put this on. We use a program called ESXi from VMware, and it literally is an ISO. You download, you stick it on, and away you go. It's just that simple. It's unbelievable to get the system up and running.
Now, Sean, I had done some looking for ESXi, and I went to the VMware website to do that, and I was overwhelmed with the number of images they had for different hardware and different classes or levels, and I got pretty confused. Did you get yours from VMware, or did you find it on a Dell website?
Go straight to the Dell website. They have everything you need on the Dell website. You don't need to go to the VM one. They'll have all the custom stuff for their particular machines. They've got all the legacy versions of it. The versions from version 2 all the way through to 6.7 or 6.8, whatever it is now for the newer machines. You'll probably find your machine is like mine's around about a 5.5 version, and there will be one specifically for your machine. That's the one to download. Go with it. Trust me. I learned the hard way.
Well, I thought, this is pretty hard. There's got to be a better way to do this. So thank you for that advice. I'll go to a Dell website and search for it that way instead of searching for it through VMware. By the way, did you try any other hypervisors besides VMware ESXi?
We were messing around with one or two on a Windows workstation, but I come from that sort of era, probably very similar to yourself. The mainframes and so on. And this is the most familiar to me, where you've got a centralized box that has some very bizarre interface on it, all command line. It looked good to me. It seems to be the one that's out there that's in most use. And it comes down to preference. Mine's ESXi. There's a lot of the other ones out there. I didn't get on with them, basically. This one's nice and easy, very simple to set up, and a great interface. Using a web browser, and that's all you need.
We've got a friend of Telos and a friend of mine personally, Alex Hartman. In fact, he's at the show this year showing off this box that is a modulation monitor for the entire FM band at one time.
Yes.
It's pretty amazing. Anyway, Alex has done a lot with ESXi as well. He tends to use HP servers. So anyway, he's made a lot of things work under ESXi. Stuff that we didn't know would work under ESXi.
Stuff we're not allowed to tell him.
Yeah, stuff we're not allowed to talk about. So, Sean, what was the next step? was the next step for you? After you got that hypervisor installed, how do you instantiate a new virtual machine?
It's very, very simple. You go literally to a web browser. You log into the hypervisor through the interface. You upload an ISO image of whatever operating system you want to do. You then register a VM machine. You point it to the ISO, and you just press start. Basically, it's that simple. You'll have a machine up and running in minutes. That's how easy it is to get these things working. The fun bit.
So I've probably spent a lot more time I've spent a lot more time worrying about how difficult this may be than I would ever spend installing an OS on a VM, right? Yeah.
All right. So.
I need to quit worrying and start doing, which is waiting for me when I get home. All right. So now you said that one of you, I think you said that you had an ENCO playout system, right?
That's correct. Yeah, I've got the ENCO DAD system. Bought it a few years back. Fantastic bit of kit. That's all I can say. Brilliant support for them guys. Same with the Telos guys. We had a lot of problems with it initially, but we got it all working. And now we've taken that and put it into a virtual environment. And the ENCO DAD playout system is now effectively running the station. All the queues, all the switching. I don't even touch the desk. It's that simple now. We actually run the cores without the controls consoles plugged in. That's how virtualized it's got.
Apart from the ENCO virtual machine, I think you said that was Win 7 running ENCO DAD, right?
Yes, that's right. Yep. Yeah, Windows 7, all Windows 10 now, so it doesn't really make much difference anymore.
Apart from that virtual machine, what if any other virtual machines do you have running to kind of help everything, help your operations?
Well, we set up a complete environment. So we've got a Windows Server 2016 on there to do all the, it's the cut server. We've got the automation server. We've got a couple of more workstations that production work run some free software, Audacity being one of them, to produce the sound bites and things like that. And we've put the whole lot on one of the blades in the server. There's four blades in my server, the blades being separate computers. And then we've effectively mirrored them and swapped them so they fail over. So if one fails, the other one takes over.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. All right. What was that difficult to set up?
It was reasonably easy, actually. It was a lot easier than I was expecting. When you get into you look on the VM site, and that is a minefield. There's tons of documentation. There's tons of clever stuff on there. Take most of it and chuck it in the bin, because the only bit you need is the ESXi, and that's all you need. They've got all sorts of other great toys, but we're not a big data center. This is a little box sat on the end of a desk, and all you need is this one little bit of software they do. You don't need to touch anything else. You can put everything on there, and you can pretty much have your environment up and running, I reckon, in about 2 hours if you plan it right.
Wow. All right. Now, I'm going to mention something I'm guessing you're not doing yet, but you certainly could. And that is running your station. Well, let's see. Are you on the air with an FM station or streaming only, or both?
We're just streaming only at the moment. We run through, weirdly enough, a 9X2 streamer, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's exactly what I'm doing at all my stations. At most of my stations, my ZipStream software running audio processing and the encoding is running on virtual machines that I didn't set up. Somebody set them up for me, and I just go into that machine with a TeamViewer or VNC, and I would deal with it that way. But somebody else set them up for me, and they're working great. So I'm looking forward to learning how to do that myself. But if you do transmit on FM, you can certainly run an FM audio processor in a virtual machine. There's Omnia SST, which is very cool, but there's others as well that are software that tend to run in Windows. And there's Breakaway One and Stereo Tool, mm-hmm. As well as Omnia SST. So you could do that. And then, I can't say it. You can transmit multiplex to your transmitter site over IP at a very nice low bit rate.
To know more, you'll have to come to the show.
To know more, you'll have to come to the Telos booth.
And after the show, if you couldn't make it, you'll have to wait for it to appear on the website.
Yeah, which actually, it might appear Monday.
Well, either way, you're not going to find out about it now.
That's right. That's right.
Even on the download, we're not going to update it.
So anyway, you can run your whole, you could run your traffic and billing if you do that.
Yeah.
On the same VM if you wanted, on the same, machine. What else could you run?
You could do everything.
You could have an FTP server or ingest. At our stations, we happen to run a program called WebGopher. And sure, lots of people make FTP program clients that go download your John Tesh program, mm-hmm. or even your hourly news. Mm-hmm. But some of these programs, and we used to do the Big Boy show from Los Angeles on one of our stations. And whoever was typing in the file names for Big Boy, oh my gosh, could not type. And so many typos. Well, you know, automation systems, Sean, correct me if I'm wrong, but usually an automation system wants the file name to be the right syntax, right?
It's pretty much got to be there. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, Rivendell's the same way. Rivendell wants the syntax. Yeah. Well, WebGopher, you could program WebGopher to, here's what the output should look like. Here's how loosey-goosey you should be on the input. And so WebGopher would learn the typical mistakes that the typist made and correct those. Some days Wednesday would be WED. Some days it'd be WDS. Some days it'd be WND.
Wow.
Right? So, yeah. Well, WebGopher would fix that. And so we replaced a, let's just say, a very bad employee with a soft piece of software, and now it's done right. Mm-hmm. And I wish the employee had done it right, but he didn't. So
that's what happens.
Yeah, that's what happens. So point was, you can virtualize that function, all that ingest, if you're a station that does that kind of thing.
Well, you know, most stations can take advantage of the virtualization, not because you're going to remove your number one assets, which is the employees or the presenters. What you should be looking at virtualization for is, how better can I do what I do now?
Right.
Like, you know, 30 years ago when I got into the business, to do a remote broadcast, an outside broadcast, it took a lot. There was a lot of heavy lifting going on, and you had to deal with the phone companies as far as dedicated phone lines in order to get the remote on the air. Now, today you can do anything with a MiFi hotspot, off you go.
Yeah.
But the thing is, because it's now so easy, or do-it-yourself approach, we forgot that, oh, by the way, the back office needs to be updated to follow. We're not doing that. Instead, what we do is we go and spend $20,000 on all this gear, throw it in the studio, and say, okay, go out there doing a remote. Do an outside broadcast. Where's the OB van? What do you mean they can't connect? Oh, we forgot to look at our inbound bandwidth. We don't have enough. Outbound. You know, these are the things. And Sean's a perfect example of, take a look at what you're trying to do. How do I do it? You know, I won't say on the cheap, but very smartly. And he says, okay, we can do this, and this. And boom. Now all of a sudden I can have 22 presenters anywhere on the globe participating in the outcome of Seagull FM.
Yeah.
Now think about that. Think about that concept, not the hardware part. Just think about what you're doing. If you're a person that really gets it, you're seeing dollar signs and great success. But nobody's doing it. However, if you're, you know, dealing with the TELUS Alliance, you're lucky because you guys are doing it and looking to do it. So you have a chance to get some of the best stuff in virtualization. That's the key.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's great. Look at us here. We're standing here doing this event from inside the NAB Convention Hall, right? And we're connecting to a network facility which is located in Queens, New York City.
Yeah.
And we're talking to a gentleman who happens to be on an island in the North Atlantic called the UK.
Yeah, that's right.
And we're all connected, and we're conversing, and people in the audience are watching this going, how do I do that? What makes sense of this? And that's what and if you're smart, you go to broadcast tools and get their stuff, and you put it into your virtualization, and before you know it, you're making money.
One thing that I'll point out in my tip. I'll wait to do my tip of the week with it. Sean, now you've installed Windows 7. You're running Enco on it. You've installed a couple other things to do. You said Audacity, so people can do some basic production. By the way, when people are doing production and editing, maybe putting a top and tail on something, are they doing that remotely? I mean, is it fast enough to get that to make working in Audacity remote worthwhile? Yeah.
Yeah, because all that's going up and down the network is the screen updates. That's it. There's all the processing. Everything you can think of is being done in the central server, and literally what's going up down the wire is very, very little network traffic, just updating screen output and keyboard inputs. I demonstrated it the other night to the station manager at his little studio, and he was gobsmacked. He was like, wow, I didn't think it would work that fast. And I said, well, at the end of the day, it will, because it's sat on a very powerful server in our office up here. That's why it's going to go so fast. And at the end of the day, there's very, very little network traffic involved between them. And all the processing is done on the actual virtual server itself. So you've got 20, 40 cores or whatever. That's a huge amount of cores to have. It's pretty much instant.
You were also mentioning, though, I was thinking about the audio. If you're doing some audio editing with Audacity, you do have a little bit of delay with the audio back and forth. Is that obviously you can work around that?
Yeah, it's minimal. You get used to it. You sort of visualize it. It's under a quarter of a second, so it's pretty much tolerable. You know, it's workable when you're doing that. And the same again when you're doing, I mean, obviously not commercial radio. You know, a 10 millisecond delay is really not going to be really noticeable when you're switching between studios and the core studios, remote studios and remote virtual studios that are going on. 10 milliseconds and under, it's not really noticeable, to be honest.
Okay, all right. Have you yet gotten into anything like putting a telephone hybrid that's remote controllable at the main site so that your presenters could take phone calls? So that to me, that involves a little bit more trickiness, but it can be done. What do you think?
Yes, it can be done. We do have a solution. We use a PhoneBox Solo. We have that virtualized. And with a little bit of clever programming with Python and a web interface, we can effectively use that as if it was sat in front of them. They use a little app on the mobile phones that we're writing at the moment to basically turn the channels on and off and bring a feed down through that app. So they can, you know, you've got the back feed, so you can talk to the guest on the phone off air. So it's a pretty simple, it's a very, very simple way of solving the problem. You think it's going to be hard. It actually isn't when you're messing around with virtualization. It's actually a lot simpler than it seems.
I'm sure we're going to see more solutions for remote phone handling as well. Some people with Telos gear have done this in a pretty sophisticated way. I'm looking to see some simpler ways too. So I'd be interested in your friends. You mentioned PhoneBox Solo. That the Broadcast Bionic Studio people are right across the hall from us. So they'll be walking in maybe any minute now. Right. We'll talk to Dan and Duncan. And by the way, Duncan. Do you know Duncan Smith with Bionics?
I've heard of his name, yes, and I think we may have even spoken on the phone once or twice. I'm not 100% sure, but I do know his name.
This coming Wednesday night at the Stratosphere Hotel, Duncan is going to be the lead singer in a band called the What's Next Band. Yeah. I think he's going by the stage name Duncan Disorderly.
Okay. Might be quite appropriate.
It's going to be pretty interesting. Actually, it's a number of musicians who happen to work at Telos. We've got a number of guitarists here and bass players, and they have a band, and they're it's kind of a one time.
So is
band.
It 2 pints minimum before you take the stage?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. We'll give you a ticket. We got tickets here at the Telos booth.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I got to watch. I got to witness this.
Yeah, it's going to be good. And Duncan,
you can remote the karaoke machine if you want. That's not a problem.
We're going to try to live stream it, but I'm not sure if we'll get DCMA cutoffs or not, or DMCA cutoffs.
Find ways.
We'll find. Yeah. Well, they probably don't sing that well, so they maybe not be able to recognize
the algorithm. Won't have a clue.
That's right.
It's Stray Cat singing.
Okay. Sean, just a minute or two, we're going to take our last break. But before we take our break, is there anything else you'd like to comment on about this process of virtualization and kind of what you've discovered along the way and advice for other people who may want to do the same thing like me?
Yeah, it's you've got to be patient with it. You will hit problems. We hit problems with the audio drivers, latency with problems, mainly the biggest issues with the live wire drivers. So it takes a lot of tuning. It does take a lot of messing around, knocking out services that don't need to be used, things like that. Eventually you'll find the perfect setup for your particular machine. Other than that, it's pretty much as if you'd put it on your beige box in the studio. There's not much in it, and it sounds like you've got a pretty damn powerful machine. The only thing we'll say is what we have been experiencing does tend to cause a little bit of a problem is getting the settings right in ESXi with the networking side of it, with the virtual switches and so on. That can cause a few dropping out issues. It's individual to each machine. What we've been finding, it varies, and it's just a matter of just playing around with the settings until you find the ones that work for your particular environment. We've got 4 or 5 machines sat on each blade. Yeah, a big server, a lot of network traffic going on. We have virtual LANs that are just carrying all the live wire audio, and then we have a virtual LAN carrying all the data as separate VLANs in there. And it's just a matter of playing around with the settings until you find the ones that, the sweet spot on each one that works for you. It's that simple. Be patient with it, and you'll get there eventually.
You know, that makes sense, and it mirrors what we found at the stations where we're doing virtualization. Again, I didn't set it up. Somebody else did, but the guy that set it up had to tweak on those settings a while. Okay, so we do the same thing. We use Axia drivers, Axia LiveWire drivers for the audio in and out, and we do that on one physical output on the back. There are, I guess, four network connections on these servers, at least on ours. And another one is for the business network, you know, the MNC type of network. And it took some playing with, but yeah, once we got it going, we haven't heard a hiccup. It works great playing audio out, ingesting audio in from the rest of the live wire network. It works great. So I'm glad to hear it took some tweaking, but you got it solved. Any more advice, Sean?
Not really. I think that pretty much covers it all. What I will say, though, is when you're selecting your server, get the biggest one you can. You need a lot of processors. You need a lot of memory. Hard drives, they're easy to upgrade. But when you get into this tech, when you start trying to upgrade processors and so on, it's a nightmare. So get the biggest one you can, biggest amount of memory, and the biggest amount of cores, and you should be fine.
We did find that... I do like to run the Omnia 9 processing in our ZipStream software for our streaming, and we did find that it does take quite a bit of processing to do Omnia 9. Now, the three-band processing that comes with ZipStream, that doesn't take much processing. That does great, and it sounds great. There's no problem with it at all. But, hey, you know, I work for the company. I'm gonna put the Omnia 9 processing on our streams, and, yeah, it wants a good couple of cores all to it. It really wants to work. On the CPUs.
We have our Omnia Zip streamer. We run the Omnia 9 for our HD stream. We do a standard one with the Omnia, the basic one, and then we have an HD stream that goes out. We've actually got that sat on its own blade because we had a lot of problems with the processing, especially when you're getting into some pretty heavy stuff on the Omnia 9 side of it with all the tweaking and everything. It was like, let's just put that one side on its own blade for now, and we'll play with that one a little bit later.
Yep. Yeah, at a couple stations, I've got them on their own computers, and a couple they're virtualized. But on the virtualized ones, we had to give them, here, you need some more resources? Here, you need, you want some more? Okay, here you go. So, yeah, Omnia 9 takes a lot. Hey, we're going to take our last break. And, Sean, it's traditional, and I didn't warn you beforehand. At the end of the show, after the last break, see if you can come up with a tip of the week for us, a tip that you can send our listeners away with, a resource, a website, a book, anything that would help our viewers out that they can really take home with them and do some homework on and listen to. I thought I had a tip of myself, and I'm sure Chris will. So we're going to be right back after our last break and hear from our friends at Lavo. We'll be right back.
There has probably never been a better time in history to buy a new radio mixing console. Today's consoles are more sophisticated than ever, with more features and functions than you can shake a stick at. But have you noticed how complicated they are? There's a sea of knobs and switches and displays and buttons. Some of them look like you might need a pilot's license to do your show. Well, a board doesn't have to be complicated to be powerful. Just look at the new Ruby mixing surface from Lavo. The first thing you notice is how smooth and streamlined it is. Ruby has lots of cool tech, but what it doesn't have is that confusing ocean of buttons that clutter things up. Now, we all know that there are some console features the jock only uses once in a while, so why dedicate controls to them? Ruby fixes this problem by moving those once-in-a-blue-moon controls to a touch-sensitive, customizable GUI that happily shares screen space with your other studio software, helping you fight control room clutter. Thanks to this design innovation, talent that use Ruby produce smoother shows with less errors. Controls that are used the most fall naturally to hand, while functions that rarely need adjustment are easily controlled with just a couple of clicks in the context-sensitive GUI. And Ruby has cool features you won't find on other boards, like Auto Mix, an intelligent gain writing function that guarantees the perfect mix for multi-mic morning shows and call-in segments. Dual mode snapshots that instantly switch the motorized faders between on-air and production modes, and enough DSP and I/O options to make even your pro sound pals green with envy. And because quality is as important to Lavo as it is to you, every console is proudly built to fanatically precise standards at Lavo's own factory in Germany. If you're ready to declutter your control room, do yourself a favor. Check out the new Ruby and the other cool Lavo radio tech at www.lawo.com/twert.
Thanks a lot to Lavo for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. And when you go to their website, please add the /twert on the end. It'll let you know that you heard the announcement here on This Week in Radio Tech. All right, it's Kirk Harnack and Chris Tobin, and we are at the Las Vegas Convention Center, where they make overhead announcements pretty frequently, don't they, Chris?
Yes, they do. Yeah. Well, that's okay. It's a pre-show announcement.
When this one's over, they'll do it in Spanish.
Well, I heard there was one coming out in French, then they're doing some other one for the different languages of vendors that come here.
So my colleague, Juan Puñed, he covers Latin America and Canada for the TELUS Alliance. And they were making – I wasn't even paying attention to this to the announcement. And Juan comes up to me and he says, hey, Kirk, he says, they're making the announcement just for me.
Yeah. Of course they are.
All right. It's time for our tip of the week. And am I the oldest guy here? I probably am.
I don't know.
I think I am. Yeah. I'm the most forgetful one. That's for sure. This thing right here, the Mickey. This is my tip of the week. I've shown it before. It's been a while, though. This is the metal box, the metal case Mickey from Technica Del Arte.
Yes.
Right? And so what it is, it's a mic preamplifier, or you can flip the switch down here and it becomes a kind of line level. And there you go. You got your mic. You plug a dynamic mic into that. And on the other end, it has the tip ring sleeve connector to go into your cell phone, right? That one, yeah, it's bent. I guess I must have pulled kind of hard on it one time.
But it works.
But I've got an iPhone 8, and it doesn't have that connector on it.
What is one to do?
Well, use the thing from Apple.
Oh, look at that.
To go from lightning to tip ring sleeve. And you know what? This actually works, and it works well. And you and I were talking during the break. I've tried a number of different solutions.
Yes.
And you have another one that works. I haven't tried that one yet, but this actually works. You get clean mic audio into your iPhone. So if you want to do a stand-up video, you want to do some kind of video recording, this is how. And by the way, this doesn't have to go to a wired mic. You could plug this into the output of a wireless mic receiver.
Which I've done.
So I've got the Sennheiser. And so I tested it with that last night. It works great. And you also get audio back out. So there's a headphone jack right there. And the volume would be adjusted in your app or on your phone. And so you get audio out. So it works almost like what we're doing right here.
And with this, if you purchase one of those Shure adapters with 15, 20, 25 dB attenuation, pop it on the front of this, you now have a line level, a more aggressive line level input.
Ah, so you can run +8 into it.
Well, I've used it on a couple of sports programs where we did some last minute things into little iOS devices, and the guy's like, I don't know, I only have line out on this. I said, not a problem. Pulled out the attenuator, my little Mickey, popped it in, off we went. The guy's looking like, what is that? I said, don't worry about it. It works.
This thing's a little over $100, yes. 120, 140,
something like that.
Yeah. Anyway, worth every penny because I've spent more and gotten stuff that still doesn't work.
Yeah, and I could say that the gentleman who designed that, the company, Joost, I have the original plastic ones. This is the newer version.
Yeah.
I have the original plastic. When they first came out with it, everyone was like, oh, what's the difference? He explained to me the differences and why he did it the way he did it.
Uh-huh.
Made total sense. And here we are 5 years later, and that little box is doing very well.
It's still the way to do it.
Yeah, it was well thought out, so I have to throw that in there. They definitely understand their stuff. They also write software, too.
Well, Sean may have a tip for us, but I'm going to hit you up first. What's your tip of the week?
Well, my tip of the week comes from Jeff Welton from the IT security air chain, of your air chain, that is, from the PREC event this morning.
By the way, when Jeff Welton talks, you pick up about 50 tips.
Oh, my goodness, yes. So essentially what he was talking about was IT security. So here's what came of it. Be sure to turn off telnet access on your devices that look out to the internet.
Yeah.
Program your router so that the WAN port does not respond to ping requests. Also, VPN solutions, look into them.
Yeah,
they're worth it. Whether you pay for it or get it for free, take the time to do it. And then the other stuff he talked about was Wireshark. It's a very good tool. It's something you want to have in-house. Also, do a testing of your ports from the outside looking in, not just inside looking out.
Yeah.
You want to see what the others are trying to do to get in, what access they might have. Also, an external media policy. External media policy, what do you mean? Let's use a scenario. You have a broadcast studio. You have presenters. You have a computer in there that they use to access the internet or other services in your studio. And it happens to have that little slot USB port, and they happen to come in from home with their little USB key because it has their favorite something on it.
Yeah.
They plug it in, and boop, malware just came. You just blocked your box. So his suggestion was, and it makes sense. I've seen it done. I've done it myself. Have a computer, non-networked computer, sitting by itself. No Ethernet wires plugged in.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then running virus scanning software, very current. Make sure it's current. And then let them plug it in. You check. If you get a green light, so to speak, if it's go, you take it. If not, you crush it. But, yes, these policies sound like, oh, you're crazy. You can't do it. Think of it this way. This is how I present it to my folks. Tell you what. Don't use these security measures. Let it happen. How much does it cost you when you can't access any of your network devices?
Yeah.
Like, think of it that way.
Yeah. Or all your files are encrypted.
Well, yeah. You can't get to any file.
Yeah.
And that means the music files that were being played out a moment ago that now is silence.
Right.
Silence is not golden radio.
No.
Silence is trouble. So these are things to consider. So I have to thank Jeff Welton from Nortel for this information. And if you were a member of APRE and you came to today's conference, you would have found this out firsthand. But now you have to go to this website, do the video, but you have to be a member first.
And a lot of these are basic things.
Oh, it's all basic stuff.
Yeah, yes. I mean, if you're into, if you watch a show like Security Now.
Steve Gibson.
Yeah, Steve Gibson, yeah. You'll learn a lot of this stuff. Also, Steve Gibson, it's not complete pen testing, but at grc.com, you can tell it what your IP address is, and it will check all your ports.
Shields up.
That's it.
Yeah, it's not pen testing at a level, say, you know, certain level 5.
Yeah.
It is definitely pen testing at level 3 because I can tell you I've used it in places where I've traveled just for fun.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, whoa. And then I search and you talk to the folks at the place I'm at and go, did you know that this is available? They're like, what? And yeah, something as simple as that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Turn off UPnP unless you know you need it.
Yes. Yes. Oh, the other suggestion was one that I made, but Jeff agreed, is if you have devices that are being port forwarded to from the outside world,
right,
change the default ports.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
so this way, even if somebody knows your IP address for the WAN, for the router, at least they can't figure out, oh, web 80 is, port 80 is a web server. So, you know, that
and that's not, you still need to have very good password on going to. Because
port forwarding is not a replacement for password.
Right. security by obscurity isn't good security. It's just a little, it keeps the easy stuff out.
Right. So just remember, if the router cannot be seen from the outside, that's the first step. It doesn't mean it's secure.
Right.
It just means that if somebody's doing an aggressive port scan across the internet, then you know you're not being hit. But they can still find other ways. Remember the website, Shodan.io.
Yeah, shoutoutshodan.io.
All you have
to do
can
be a tip every week.
That's a weekly tip, and I go through it at least once or twice a week just for fun.
Yeah.
And Jeff found some stuff. We were talking, and he's like, yeah, it's kind of scary. He as a manufacturer, is like even panicked because, like, yeah, I found a few clients. I have to send them an email. Hey, dude, guess what? Your transmitter is available. How do you know? I'm sitting looking at the ratings right now.
Hey, Sean, do you have a tip of the week you can pass along to our viewers?
Yeah, I think the tip of the week I would give is when you're playing with these proprietary systems, make sure you always go to the manufacturer's website first and have a look there for anything you need to find out in terms of drivers, OSs to run them. That's the best thing before you have to hit VM or anything like that for the generic versions of the SXI or any other hypervisor or anything like that. Definitely go to the manufacturer's site first. It saves a lot of aggravation, trust me.
And this is true.
Exactly,
this is true for a lot of support kind of issues.
Oh yeah,
you know, it's easy to put a question out there on Facebook or some other or Reddit or some other forum, and if you ask, you know, you're going to get a lot of different answers from people who have experience from 15 years ago or 5 years ago or maybe never. They're just guessing. And I'm sure you can occasionally get good advice, and it's good to ask other people. But if you're having a problem with a specific piece of gear, and I know if you're having a problem with a piece of Telos, Omnia, Axia gear, talk to the support guys there because they know this stuff inside and out.
Mm-hmm.
They really
do.
All right, cool. Sean, thank you for staying up so late.
Yes,
and thank you. I have confidence now. When I get home, I'm going to rip into that server box and plug that sucker in, and I'll go look for the right ISO on the Dell website and get the right thing. So thanks for passing this information along. I appreciate it.
Not a problem. Yeah, you have my US number, so I will expect a call.
Oh, no, I don't want to have to call you for support, but unless it's emotional support, I'll give you a call for that. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot. Sean Kelly with Seagull.fm, Seagull.fm. And programming there is a lot of Sean's responsibility, at least the technical back end is certainly.
Absolutely.
Hey, I want to thank you for being on our show, Chris.
You're welcome.
Appreciate you coming by. Our show next week happens actually the expo closes at the same moment that our show usually starts. So next week, we're going to have a little bit different show. We're going to bring you highlights from around the NAB show next week and play them back for you. Instead of trying to do a live show when everything's shutting down,
right,
we're going to bring you best of the NAB next week at the usual time, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern time, 2 Pacific. And Chris and I will be doing a few interviews around the show for the next week. All right. Hey, I want to thank Suncast for taking care of us very well today, producing the show. Thanks to Andrew Zarian as well, the founder of the GFQ Network. And we'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.